Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear Blood River Radio family, it was so nice having people on that I love. The people that come on this program, I really do love them dearly. Like, they're brothers and sisters as far as I'm concerned. And Matt the Mole, buddy, what a story will you tell? Matt the Mole, we rode together to Charlottesville with the other guy on this program right now, Gene, the bitter ender, still bitter, more bitter than ever, bitter ender. We rode to Charlottesville together. And me and Matt talked about that earlier. That's something we were forged in. Fours in the heat of battle. I will never forget Charlottesville. I know they won't, as long as we got our mind, but it was so good to have Matt the Mole on. And I would like to reiterate, too, what I said. Without Matt the Mole Goodwin, there would be no Blood River Radio. He was one of our original co-hosts, him and Jacob Tyler. And Matt the Mole poured a lot of money into the show earlier in the beginning. It took us a lot of money in the beginning, and we're making, thank God to our supporters, we're making airtime now. But a couple of times there, it was a pretty nip and tuck. Mr. Buddy saved us a couple of times. I never thought we'd make it past a year, but we did. But it was so good to have our other Charlottesville buddy on along, and Gene will always be super special to me. I know he feels the same way about the rest of the Charlottesville guys.
They saved us. The young guys like Matthew and some of the other younger ones were up front battling the Antifa, and I mean battling it literally, physically, you know, trying to save us, the old geezers in the background, yeah, in the rear with the gear, as they say. Yeah. And had not been for those young guys, we would have just been stomped on the sidewalk there.
No doubt.
Hit with all kind of bottles of screws and nails, glass bottles they were throwing at us, bags of feces and urine. And they never mentioned that on the TV. They said, "Oh, well, they were white supremacists and Klansmen there, you know, and that's all they ever hear on TV." No, and we played by their stupid rules and actually had a permit to be there. Lee Park and speak up for General Lee, and you know, we got attacked about two blocks before we ever got to the park. So I think people need to realize what lying dogs they are in the media and the government. It was a set-up job by the government in Charlottesville and the federal government, too, to stifle any kind of talk against the empire. So, you know, they turned Antifa loose on us, and that worthless dirtbag, slimy Jew mayor, and his told his police force to stand down, not do a darn thing. So the police were just standing around all day while we were being attacked with their thumbs stuck up their rear end. So, you know, we won't get into that today.
I'll say one more thing. Gene, I've used Matt made a quote that I've used it since then. He said, "We marched over those son of a bitches going into the park, and then we marched over those son of a bitches coming back out of the park." And one more comment. We had a fella in a compound where me and you and Matt and Rich and others stayed. And we did a radio program that night, and to this day, to this very day, Sam Bushman will tell you, that radio broadcast we did in Charlottesville broke all records. He said it crashed the servers, whatever the hell that means. They had to go get more bandwidth. It stands to this day as the greatest radio broadcast that Liberty News, Blood River Radio, to Political Cesspool ever has done. Nothing has ever before or since equaled that program. But we had a fella in there, funny as hell. I'll make this quick. He was about 6'4", 6'5". I made a massive young man, about 20 years old, football player from the state of Florida. And he said, when those niggas started that and those Antifa started that fight with us in that parking garage, he said, we taught them sons of bitches a lesson they ain't never going to figure it out. I'm going to tell you what, he was a 6'5", 300-pound-plus solid muscle football player. And I'll tell you what, he kicked some royal ass that day. Anyway, I just thought maybe I always think about that. We have Bad on, have you on. I always think about that. I always do, Zane. I hope I didn't get you sidetracked.
Matthew saved us. There's no doubt about that, because he was up front and had that shield on his face, and he was getting splattered with all kind of, you know, like, what's that spray that they spray in your eyes and all that stuff.
They had CS gas out there.
I can smell that shit. And that crazy black guy went running at us with that homemade flamethrower. He lit up an aerosol can. So this was of course, they never mentioned that. It was just we were the villains because we were there and trying to speak up for our Confederate history. So anyway, one other thing I wanted to throw in, it's a little bit off our subject today. I just got my copy of Chronicles Magazine, Magazine of the American Culture, and they've got an article in here entitled How the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, Invented the Hate Crimes and Leading to the Conviction of Innocent Men. And the article is about Gregory and Travis McMichael and that crazy black that, you know, tried to come after him with their shotgun, the Ahmaud Arbery case down in Georgia.
Yep.
And I hadn't read it all the way through, but I thought we'd throw that out there as another example of what the government does, that set-up trial that they had for that. Those two men were guilty before they ever went into the courthouse. So, you know, they just put on a Soviet show trial.
Gee, you know, it's funny you said that because I talked to Miss McMichael. It's been about 5 days ago. I haven't spoke with her in a long time. And I won't say much, but she just said that they're not giving up hope. They got something going. That's all I can say. I mean, she couldn't tell me a whole lot. But
I hope they do.
Yep, she said she's doing well as far as, like, God himself is holding her up. The guys are doing good. They're in good shape. I don't know how in the hell they could be in good spirit. I'd have already committed suicide probably. I couldn't stand being locked up in prison like that. But she's doing okay. And keep your prayers. You know, Trump could have gotten them out eons ago, but that sorry bastard hadn't done anything for them. But anyway,
if they were Jews, they'd have gotten them out for sure.
Oh yeah, or blacks. If it had been blacks, some raping some 19-year-old college girl, they'd already be out. No doubt about it. But it's funny you mentioned that because I hadn't spoke with her in a long time. And I'll say one more thing for Blood River Radio. Blood River Radio is the only news media that the McMichaels ever used. And through Blood River Radio, we got to take credit where credit's due. Thanks to Blood River Radio, we got John Friend did an interview when he was with American Free Press with Miss McMichaels. But Blood River Radio, we had to go to bat for him, buddy, because he trusted us. And thanks to the reason he trusted us, Mr. Buddy had told her all about Blood River Radio, Gene, and how we operate. And she said we're the only media she could trust. And so I like our people to know, the people who listen to us, take our accolades when we can. But anyway, I hope I didn't get you too far off track, brother.
No. That's fine. You know, we talk about we want to have Confederate history in the month where it happened or where it's the month that it's important. And last week we talked about the first battle between the ironclad ships, the Confederate ironclad, the Virginia and the Monitor, and that was on March the 9th, 1862. And for this week's program, we got another March date coming up, March the 17th, which is St. Patrick's Day, but it's also the birthday of a very, very famous Confederate general, Patrick Ronayne Cleburne. And he was born in County Cork, Ireland. In fact, like I was reading here, March 17, 1828, in Bridge Park Cottage on the River Bride, 10 miles west of Cork, Ireland. And then his father was a doctor, and he studied, was tutored in the Episcopal Church School education, and then apprenticed himself to a pharmacist to prepare for a medical exam. But he failed the examinations because he wasn't very good in Latin, and he was so embarrassed and felt that put a mark of shame on his family. He ran away and enlisted in the British Army, 41st Regiment of Foot, and to kind of hide out and get away from things and take the shame away from his family. It didn't take him long to figure out he made a bad mistake there, because in those days, enlisted men were just treated like dirt in the British Army and severely beaten, and they beat you into shape. And it had two effects on him, though. One, he learned a lot about military drill and military tactics, but it also, he learned how not to treat the enlisted men. And when he got the rank in the Confederate Army, he was, you know, strict on what they were doing, but he was a great leader, and the men, his enlisted men loved him because of the way he took care of them as far as making sure they were well-trained and fed. So anyway, he finally, after 3 years, he purchased his discharge and immigrated to the United States with his brother and sister in 1849, and they came through the port of New Orleans and went upriver to Cincinnati, Ohio, and he got a job there as a pharmacist. And then his brother and sister stayed in Cincinnati, but a friend of his convinced him to come downriver to Helena, Arkansas, which he did. And he then later became a partner in a drugstore. And he studied law, became a passed the bar exam in Arkansas, and did very well. And at the outbreak of the war, or when it looked like the war was coming, he was a very successful businessman as a law and in the apothecary business, they called it back then, instead of the drugstore. And we'll say a little bit more about General Claiborne's military career after we get back from the break.
I think General Claiborne might have been my favorite.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you know what is great about America? Ask an Immigrant. Ask an Immigrant is a new podcast dedicated to helping Americans, especially our youth, value, appreciate, and be grateful for the freedoms we have here in America. Join host Lydia Wallace Nuttall as she interviews immigrants from around the world to discover their inspiring personal stories about why they came to America. To learn more about why America is the most prosperous, greatest country in the world, download the Loving Liberty app or go to lovingliberty.net.
Hello, friends. This is Jacob from Blood River Radio. We call the kings into account and tell the truth to shame the devil on this show every week because we are of the firm conviction that our cause cannot succeed without true revival amongst the remnant, amongst that principled minority of the dispossessed majority. Now is the time to stand and be counted, to do like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who would not bow down to the false idols of their day, even under pain of death, like the 300 mighty men of valor who surrounded the Midianites with Gideon, or the 7,000 men that God told the prophet Elijah had not bowed their knees to Baal in a time when even calling fire down from heaven would not awaken our kinsmen from their slumber. If you are encouraged by our labors in the trenches for the kingdom and the cause of truth, liberty, and righteousness, I urge you to consider supporting this program. No donation is too small. We can do with thousands or even hundreds what our enemies and the powers and the principalities of this present darkness need tens of millions to do. So please donate today at BloodRiverRadio.com and help us take up the hedge and stand in the gap against the great evils of our time.
In the medical field, IT security is crucial. Our highly skilled consultants are HIPAA certified and have 20 plus years of experience servicing medical clinics, billing and supply companies. We offer comprehensive endpoint protection, guarding your computers and servers against all stages of threats. And with our 24/7 monitoring services, you'll never worry about extensive downtime again. Ready to level up your IT support? Call 801-706-6980 today and discover how great IT services can be with Managed IT Services.
Let me tell you something, boy, if I did give you power, you got nothing. Nobody gives you power. Real power is something you take.
Real power is something you take, people. That soundbite's not just for entertainment. You keep it in mind all the time. Real power is you have to take it. You really do. I want to thank Gene so much for coming in here. I take such great pride in being a white man, and especially being a white Southerner. There's no place like the South, at least it used to be that way. And G comes in here every week trying to instill true history, trying to put some character, especially in our young people. And I just hope you people will appreciate a little bit of the caliber this man is right here. And I hang on every word he says. I learn something all the time. In fact, I'm going to hear him shut the hell up. I never even knew much about General Claiborne until Gene told me about it. But General Claiborne was probably, he's in the top four. It was Lee, Stonewall, Forrest, and Claiborne. I love those. When I've heard about those guys, the best of the best of the best. I mean, right back to you, Gene. I hope I didn't throw you off track.
You made an interesting point during the break there, Eddie. You were talking about a comparison between General Claiborne and Forrest. And the Irish pronounce, his name is spelled C-L-E-B-U-R-N-E, but the Irish pronounce it like it was C-L-A-Y, Claiborne. But the town in Texas is named after him, and they call it Claiborne, Texas, out there. Anyway, be that as it may, you made the comparison between Claiborne and Forrest that neither one of them went to West Point, and yet they were very successful officers in their commands, Claiborne in the infantry and Forrest in the cavalry, and they were very highly respected. not at the at that time, though, by the Confederate government, because they couldn't see him as being any good as an officer unless they'd been to the club, you know, been to West Point or VMI or the Citadel or some military school. It wasn't until late in the war they found out how their talent had been wasted. And there were other things, too, that Claiborne made his money starting pretty much just as an apprentice in an apothecary shop or drugstore in Helena, and studied law and had a very successful career as a lawyer in Helena. And then when the war looked like it was coming, he volunteered as a private in the 15th Arkansas Infantry Regiment. But then at the urging of his friends, he got elected as company commander. And then later on went to, just marked the beginning of his career as a brilliant military man. He soon made colonel of the regiment. And then under Major General William J. Hardy spent the fall and winter of 1861 in the vicinity of Bowling Green, Kentucky. And they said his British military training, discipline, and charm earned him the loyalty of his men, Hardy's friendship, and a temporary command as a brigade commander. And then on March the 4th, 1862, his rank became permanent when Claiborne received his Brigadier General's commission. And then the first big battle that he fought in started, jumped right into it at the Battle of Shiloh. And his brigade was on the left of the Confederate attack. And after initially being thrown back, Claiborne rallied his brigade and shoved the Federals through their camps and over to the bank of the Tennessee River. So they went from the left of the battlefield all the way over to the right. And they took heavy casualties, though, during that fighting. His command had been reduced to only 800 men left by the end of the day, and it should have been 2,000 or 3,000. He stopped a counterattack against the Confederates, and then along with Forrest fought a rare good action the next day after the bulk of the Confederate Army retreated from Shiloh. Of course, we talked about this about Forrest before. That night, Forrest and some of his men put on Union overcoats and crawled along the riverbank to Pittsburgh Landing, and they saw Buell's army that had come down from Nashville being ferried across the river that night. And that's where Forrest warned the Confederate commanders, said, look, we're going to be outnumbered tomorrow. They're bringing in reinforcements across the river. We need to do something tonight. Even if we have to launch a night attack. And they didn't pay any attention to him. I mean, he wasn't a West Pointer. And so he was only a colonel, regimental commander. And so they ignored him. And then, of course, the next day, the Confederates were severely outnumbered, and Grant and Buell and the army they had drove them off the field. So anyway, then Claiborne, he was given a higher command in August that year, Bragg's invasion of Kentucky. Claiborne's division fought at Richmond, Kentucky. And they completely routed the Federal Army off the field. One of the worst defeats that the United States Army had ever received was at Richmond, Kentucky. He was in command of two brigades. And then on the morning of the 30th of August, while readying his men for the second day's fight, he was shot through the cheek, and a bullet carrying away several teeth before it exited out the other side of his mouth. And he was unable to speak. He had to give up his command, but he was healed up and had such scars on his face. That's when he grew the beard. And the picture of Claiborne's always famous with a mustache and beard, kind of a goatee, and he didn't have a beard up until he got that horrific wound right through his face. In December of 1862, he was rewarded with the vote of appreciation by the Confederate Congress and raised to the rank of Brigadier General Commission. Then in the 1864 campaigns, he really proved himself in the fighting between Chattanooga and Atlanta. And part of his organizational skills, he organized a sharpshooters battalion, and they got these British Whitworth rifles that were sort of the state-of-the-art rifle of their day, and they fired a hexagon shell. They had a hexagon barrel, and it was drilled out as a hexagon shape in the barrel, and fired a hexagon-shaped rifle, and then they had the telescopic sights they put on them were real long, almost as long as the barrel. So what Claiborne would do, he picked out some of the best shots in his division and armed them with these sharpshooter rifles, and they would put them out to the close to the front line. So if the Yankees started to use artillery on his infantry, the sharpshooters would pick off the gunners. So now they had the choice. If they were going to lose their artillery, they had to bring up infantry to support their artillery. And when they did that, then the Confederate artillery would open on them because now they had some easy targets to take care of. So he was always looking at ways to improve his command and make him more deadly on the battlefield, and that was one of the ways he did. He was very innovative in this sharpshooter battalion that he had organized. And the other thing he did, he learned, as we said, from the British Army, how you don't just beat the enlisted men into the ground to make them better soldiers, but he trained them the things that they would really use, and he was inspecting rifles one day of some of the soldiers. And the way they do this, I know you probably did it too, Eddie, when you were in basic, they would put a clean piece of cloth
yes.
through the hole right below the part of the ramrod where you ram the charge and the powder in, and run that clean cloth down the barrel and then pull it out. And if there's any dirt or anything on it, if the rifle hadn't been cleaned very well, part of that black powder was on there, then you were caught with a dirty rifle. So instead of taking the men out for beatings or anything, they would then have to clean every rifle in that rifle company, which would be about 100 men. So they got an idea that, you know, you want to make your rifle as clean as you could. So, and a black powder rifle is just really, really dirty. It's
pitiful.
Not like the cartridges that you fire, but that black powder, it doesn't all of it burn, and a lot of it's caked on the inside of the barrel. So you really have to clean that very often to keep it firing as you should. So anyway, he fought at the battle at Murfreesboro in December and January 1st and 2nd of December of 1862, January 1st and 2nd, 1863, and then fought in the Tullahoma campaign from Tullahoma, Tennessee, all the way down through Chattanooga and at Chickamauga. And one of the things they said about Claiborne's division was that they had a very unique flag. It was in Hardee's Corps. It was a blue flag and had a white circle in the middle of it, or a white oval. And they would have the regimental number inside of that circle and their battle honors painted on the flag. And I've seen some of Claiborne's regimental battle flags in museums, and the whole flag was covered up with battle honors that were painted on there in gold paint. Whoa. From Chickamauga to Rossville to all the different areas that his unit had been. And they were one of the most highly respected units in the Confederate Army. Now, the bad thing about it was the Yankees knew who Claiborne was, too. And they said when Claiborne's division came on the field at Chickamauga, every rifle in the Federal line was turned on his division because they knew if they didn't take him out early, they were going to be in trouble. And General Claiborne lost his attack and broke through the Federal lines and drove them back through the woods about a mile there. So even the whole Yankee army coming after him didn't slow him down. So after the Battle of Chickamauga, of course, the Yankee army was driven back over Missionary Ridge and into Chattanooga. And going back to Forrest again, he was chasing the Federals up and over Missionary Ridge and got up on top of the ridge and captured a signal tower. And he got there so fast, the Yankees that were up on the signal tower couldn't get down off the tower and get away to Chattanooga. So he ordered them to come down. They had a big telescope up there spying on the Confederates, seeing what the Confederates were doing. He turned the telescope around and saw the disaster that was going on in Chattanooga. And he was sending couriers back to Bragg, telling them the Federals are beaten, they're disorganized, demoralized, bring up the army and finish them off, let's go. And Bragg wouldn't do anything. He sat in his tent and he sulked because his battle plans hadn't been followed. Of course, Confederates had won a huge victory, and Forrest was just furious that Bragg wouldn't do anything about it. In fact, most of the Confederate officers were furious about it. So anyhow, that was at Chickamauga. And then the Confederates decided to lay siege to the city of Chattanooga and starve the Yankees out. And they were doing a fairly decent job of it until November of 1863, and they sent Grant and Sherman east to take over the command of the army from William Rosecrans, who got him into this mess after he lost at Chickamauga. And they attacked the Confederates on Lookout Mountain and drove them off of Lookout Mountain. So that meant that the Tennessee River now was open into Chattanooga where they could get supplies. And we'll talk about the battle at Missionary Ridge that Claiborne fought on the northern end of Missionary Ridge after our break.
All righty. Be right back, folks.
Your daily Liberty Newswire. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
News this hour from Town Hall. I'm Mary Rose. Correspondent Julie Walker reports on the U.S. military plane that went down in Iraq, killing all six crew members.
Celebration marking Quds or Jerusalem Day in Tehran. Now, this airstrike came after the Israelis only a short time earlier had warned that they were going to target an area near Tehran University. That's where this Quds Day celebration was taking place.
Jet fuel prices are increasing, and that could mean we'll pay higher airfares.
Airline ticket prices are starting to climb as carriers respond to rising jet fuel costs tied to the war in Iran. Some international carriers already have raised their fares or added fuel surcharges. Experts say fares increase, but when and by how much? And that can be hard to predict. Industry analysts say the impact of higher jet fuel costs can vary based on the route, airline, and travel demand. I'm Mike Hempen.
Talks between the U.S. and Cuba are ongoing.
After several days of speculation, President Díaz-Canel announced that talks between Cuba and the United States have taken place. He added that any negotiations must respect equality, each country's political system, and Cuba's sovereignty and self-determination. Díaz-Canel also said that no oil has entered Cuba in 3 months. Calling the impact of U.S. energy blockade tremendous.
More on these stories at townhall.com.
You know, life moves fast. Staying sharp, focused, and clear-headed isn't always easy. That's why the same company that brings you Relief Factor has developed something brand new, ThinkFactor. ThinkFactor is made to help you think clearer and perform better daily. It's a powerful blend of nutrients that unlocks mental clarity and precision, nurtures your memory, boosts your attention. With ThinkFactor, brain power and performance finally meet for lasting daily results. Supercharge your memory, mental sharpness. Your brain is your most valuable asset, powering your creativity, focus, and daily performance. If you're feeling mentally foggy, give it a try. After a couple of weeks of taking ThinkFactor, it was a game changer for me. Look, the longer you take ThinkFactor, the better it works for you. If you've ever thought you want to be more clear, more focused, call 800-4-RELIEF, 800-4-RELIEF, or visit ReliefFactor.com to learn more and order ThinkFactor. Your first bottle is just $19.95. ThinkFactor. Think clearer, perform better daily. Call 800-4-RELIEF or visit ReliefFactor.com for ThinkFactor.
Home sales.
This is attorney Jason Rupp, general counsel of the Knights Party based out of Harrison, Arkansas, and proud supporter of Blood River Radio. I, like you, am concerned about the destruction of our beloved America and our racial kindred people and our cherished liberties. As an individual and as a nation, liberty is what we seek. Liberty is important. It is what allows us to be independent. And if properly used, liberty allows us to fully worship God in all areas of life. And with that worship comes more liberty. We are on the verge of anarchy in this country, and personal liberty is looked upon as a crowning achievement of the people. However, Christianity and white law and order is viewed as the enemy of this newfound freedom, and that is why it is under attack. Learn more by listening to Blood River Radio every Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m.
Experience the untamed spirit of the American West with Range Magazine. Each issue is a visual journey featuring award-winning photography and compelling stories that capture the heart of ranching and rural life. Stay informed on the challenges and triumphs of those who live and work on the land. Subscribe today and receive quarterly editions delivered to your doorstep, and join a community that cherishes the enduring legacy of the Western frontier. Visit rangemagazine.com to subscribe.
Are you ready to stand up for your community and support your local sheriff? Join the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association and become a vital member of the Sheriff's Citizens Posse. At CSPOA.org, we empower citizens like you through weekly webinars, arming you with the knowledge to back your constitutional county sheriff. Together, we can uphold our Constitution and ensure liberty and justice for all. Your community needs you now more than ever.
come in the morning. Smells like victory.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Cool, they're red, white, and blue.
Well, y'all, here's y'all general. This is General Gene coming back to lecture. You better not be late. You better pay attention to class. So go ahead, Peter. Go ahead, Peter.
And bring your blue notebook and a number two pencil for the test.
Got that right, buddy.
All right.
Got that
no,
right.
We, before the break, we were talking about Patrick Claiborne and his division on Missionary Ridge. That was in November of 1863. And the Confederates were holding Missionary Ridge and Lookout Mountain, and they were trying to starve the Yankees out of Chattanooga. And Bragg, in his brilliance, he sent James Longstreet and his two divisions that had come down from Virginia that helped them win the Battle of Chickamauga. He sent them off to Knoxville to try to capture Knoxville. So by splitting up his army and not really attacking either Knoxville or Chattanooga, he wound up losing both of them and having the Yankees break the siege at Chattanooga and at Knoxville. So nice job there, Bragg. Anyway, so Claiborne's division was on the north end of Missionary Ridge. And if we can get our listeners to kind of imagine a line going from the bottom of their page up to the top, Missionary Ridge runs north and south. And so Claiborne was up at the top of the page, the northern end of it. And he was under attack all day by General Sherman's entire corps. There were about four divisions going against his one division. And they spent most of the morning attacking what they thought was Missionary Ridge, but it was just a small hill kind of down off the ridge a little ways on the northern end. It was just an outpost for the Confederates. And they finally drove the Confederates off, and they just kind of skipped off the mountain, that hill, and through a valley and back up to the main position on Missionary Ridge. And when Sherman found out that he'd spent almost half a day attacking just an outpost, I think that's when he came up with that saying that war is hell, because it sure was for him that day. Then he got into the real fight against Claiborne's division up there. And Sherman never set foot on the top of Missionary Ridge. Every attack that he tried against Claiborne's division and that northern end of Missionary Ridge, they were thrown back. And I'm not 100% sure if it was Claiborne's men or somebody a little further south was supporting him. But that's where, if you look at your map you've drawn up on your dinner table there, on the right side of Missionary Ridge, or the east side, Confederates went through the railroad tunnel that ran through Missionary Ridge. So they entered on the east side, went through the tunnel, came out on the west side. They came out behind Sherman's attack. They just did a right face or right flank movement and swung up the mountain and attacked Sherman from the rear and threw him pretty much off the mountain there by being attacked from the rear. And Claiborne would do that. He would have his units in reserve on the reserve slope, the backside, and whenever they needed reinforcements, they would bring them up over the Missionary Ridge and kind of down on the west side and then attack Sherman's troops from the flank. And I used to make a lot of color slides about different battles out here like Shiloh and Murfreesboro and Nashville to use for talks on it. And I was up there on Missionary Ridge with my camera one time, and I knew the tunnel was around there somewhere because I could see the railroad tracks coming up from the east and then where they went over the mountain and down into Chattanooga. And I said, well, I know this tunnel's around here somewhere. It's got to be here. And I was kind of poking around through the weeds and everything. All of a sudden stepped off a ledge and went boom, 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 hitting on my rear end, bouncing down a 10 or 15-foot drop on rocks and hitting the ditch down at the bottom. I looked up, and I go, oh, there's the railroad, and there's the tunnel. Yeah, I knew it was around here. So at the cost of a sore rear end and muddy blue jeans, I found the tunnel and took my pictures. At least I didn't break the camera when I was doing that. So that was going on up there. So Claiborne held that position all day. Sherman never got to the top of it. But the irony of the whole thing is when the Parks Department built a little a park there at the northern end of Missionary Ridge, they call it the Sherman Reservation. And I thought, are you kidding me? He never got here. It should have been the Claiborne Reservation. And another interesting thing that happened, RSCV camp used to take field trips. And one of our field trips was to Chattanooga, and we were up there on Missionary Ridge and looking around. And they did have a big metal sign up there, like they have in a lot of the national parks, that lists the units that were fighting there. And one of the members of our SCV camp, Roger Young, he said, well, I had ancestors here, and they were in the 3rd Kentucky. And we were looking at that sign. I said, yeah, that's the 3rd Kentucky. And I had my great-great-grandfather here in the 50th Tennessee. So we had a picture of Roger standing on one side of this sign pointing to the 3rd Kentucky. I was standing on the other side of the sign pointing at the 50th Tennessee. And I thought, how ironic that two Confederate soldiers had their great-great-grandsons there at the same spot where they were fighting during that November battle in 1863.
You can't
so anyway, the Confederates had to fall back. The line broke further south, right in the middle of their line, down on Missionary Ridge, so they had to fall back. And Claiborne's division, of course, was the last ones off the mountain and trying to save the artillery and everything like that. And then they were retreating back down across the state line into Georgia. And then Claiborne's division set a trap at Ringgold Gap. And what they did, they had a broken-down wagon in the creek there, and they unhitched the mules or the horses, and they had several soldiers down there fooling around with it like they're trying to get this wagon out of the creek. And then he put three or four wagons up on top of the hill that went through the gap. And so when the Federal Army was coming, they said, oh, man, we've got them now. They're just right ahead of us. They can't even get away. That wagon's broken down. There's the end of their column of wagons and everything. So they went rushing into this gap. And when they rushed into Ringo Gap, the whole gap just exploded all the way around them. Claiborne had his marksman artillery in kind of a U shape around the mountain there at the gap and just mowed down. It was General Hooker that had been in the Union Army in Virginia and just mowed them down and kept the gap open so the Confederates with all their supply wagons and artillery and everything could get all the way down toward Dalton, Georgia. And he received a congratulatory thanks from the Confederate Congress for his stand at Ringo Gap. And in all these Claiborne regimental flags that we were talking about, that Ringo Gap was one of the battles that was painted on their flag, Chickamauga, Ringo Gap, Missionary Ridge, and in parentheses it said North on the Claiborne regimental flags. So then that wound up 1863, went into winter quarters in Dalton, Georgia, and Claiborne wrote a letter to President Davis and the Confederate War Department in Richmond suggesting that they enlist the blacks in the Confederate Army. It said he was like Forrest. He knew we couldn't win a war of attrition. We just didn't have the numbers. And he said, in condition for their freedom, if they fought and served in the Confederate Army, they get their freedom. And we need the manpower. We can't replace the losses we take. We may win battles, but we can't replace the losses. And that went over like the proverbial lead balloon. And that pretty much condemned him not to ever be promoted again. And there were two things that were kind of held against him. Number one, he wasn't a Native American. He is a naturalized citizen from Ireland. And there was a lot of prejudice against the Irish at that time because they were Catholics. And they didn't want somebody in a high position that had more loyalty to the Pope than they did to the U.S. government. But the thing was, Claiborne and his family were Protestants in Ireland. They weren't Catholics, but just because he was from Ireland, that was held against him. And then when he sent that letter to the government suggesting that they use the blacks as troops in the Confederate Army, like I said, that just was a bombshell that pretty much ended his possibility of being raised up in command. And a lot of historians think had he been an Army Corps commander or if he had taken over the Army of Tennessee after Bragg had resigned in place of or Joe Johnston or John Bell Hood, the outcome of the war in the Western theater would have probably been entirely different from what it was. But he never got a chance to get that promotion. So anyway, he fought in all of the battles in the Atlanta campaign, Kennesaw Mountain, Jonesboro. In fact, he saved the Confederate Army at Jonesboro. Sherman had gotten around Hood, and Joe Johnston had been replaced, and they put Hood in charge because they wanted somebody that was a fighter and not constantly retreating. And then, you know, Hood launched three attacks against Sherman around Atlanta, at Peachtree Creek, Ezra Church, and then the Battle of Atlanta itself. And just, you know, as Hood did, he left a field of casualties after every battle he commanded. And they still couldn't stop Sherman. Sherman swung around down to Jonesboro, south of Atlanta, and was ready to march into Atlanta. And Claiborne's division got there on pretty much on the run and stopped him and saved Atlanta long enough for Hood to pull their army together and then abandon the city of Atlanta. Then Claiborne was with Hood's army when they made the march back up through Georgia and across northern Alabama in the attempt to come into Tennessee and recapture Nashville and try to get some situation going to affect the presidential election that was coming up in November. But by the time they got into Tennessee, across the time they got across the Tennessee River and into Tennessee, it's too late. the presidential election was always already over first Tuesday in November, and Lincoln had been reelected. So whatever they did in Tennessee wasn't going to affect the presidential election. Claiborne and his division were on the field at Spring Hill, and this was a lot of controversy there about what happened that night on November 29th. And we'll get into that right after we get back from the break and talk about the last battle that General Claiborne fought in at Franklin, Tennessee.
Yes, sir. And I got a question to ask about General Hooker when we come back, since you brought him up. Be right back, folks.
This is a battle between truth and deceit, a battle between forces that would enslave this country in darkness and between a media that wants to present you with the truth.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by 6 corporations. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in fact.
TheEpochTimes.com.
During our war for Southern independence, the brilliant Confederate general Robert E. Lee foretold the decline of this country when he prophesied, "If those people," referring to the dictatorial federal government, "if those people win this war, the United States will become a bully abroad and a tyrant at home." As Lee predicted, it has come to pass. The principles laid out in our founding documents, our Declaration of Independence, and the individual rights protected in our Constitution have been vilified and discarded. But not everyone has surrendered. Blood River Radio brings you highly respected, intelligent guests not afraid to speak the truth when the truth in America today is censored and attacked. Your contributions keep us on the air in order to fight against the bullies abroad and the tyrants at home. Send your war contributions to Blood River Radio, P.O. Box 34636, Bartlett, Tennessee 38184. That address is on our website, www.bloodriverradio.com. Don't let the bullies and the tyrants win.
Looking for an IT partner that truly understands your needs? Managed IT Services is the answer. We meet with you regularly to discuss your goals and form a tailored technology plan. Our customers have called us a trusted advisor who delivers. When it comes to IT, we do it all. Firewalls, cloud storage, server migration, and more. Say goodbye to long-term contracts and hello to a team that earns your business month after month. Call 801-706-6980 now and let Managed IT Services transform your IT experience.
Dear Blood River Radio family, thank you so much for holding on. I'm enjoying this immensely. I hope I don't slow up the General Gene, the bitter end, or still bitter, more bitter than ever.
Well, no, I'm just a lieutenant. I never got past first lieutenant. That was my highest rank in the Marine Corps.
So. Well, I had asked the bitter ender if when General Hooker was at Missionary Ridge, if he had his ladies with him, you know, the hookers, and I was also say that I remember I learned from the Professor Gene that when I think it was Sherman, when he was asked if the black troops were as good as any, and I think he said something like, "Well, they stop a bullet just as well as a sandbag,"
what he said. A black can stop a bullet as good as a white man, but a sandbag is better because you didn't have to feed a sandbag.
So. Oh, God. Okay.
He wasn't real high on using black troops in the U.S. Army, and it never happened in the Confederate Army either till right till the end of the war. They realized they need to do something. And here's another thing that they don't tell you about, and if you're watching The View for history, you're not going to get this on The View or CNN.
I'll bet.
That the Confederate Army was integrated in 1861, that blacks served alongside white Confederates, not in as large a numbers as they served in the U.S. Army, because they had, you know, black regiments, USCT, United States Colored Troop regiments.
Oh.
But the Confederates never had an all-black regiment, but they had them serving alongside their white neighbors or somebody from their plantation, because the boys had grown up together. They went fishing together. They went swimming together. They knew each other since the time they were toddlers. And the war came along, and the black kids from the plantation went with the white kids that they knew and joined the Confederate Army. And they said, "Oh, that never happened. That never happened. No, they wouldn't. Why would they fight for slavery?" Well, maybe they were smarter than the blacks are today, and they knew they weren't fighting for slavery. So their homes were being burned, and black women were being attacked and raped. So they felt like they were defending their homes and defending their family members. And they said, well, that never happened. You can't prove that. Oh, yes, you can, because after the war, former Confederate soldiers could apply for a pension from state governments. And the South was pretty well, you know, economically destroyed. It wasn't much of a pension, just a few dollars a month, but it was better than nothing. And there are blacks that received a pension after the war for their service. And to get a pension, you had to be in a combat unit, infantry, artillery, cavalry. You couldn't be a teamster and drive a wagon or be a nurse on the field or a cook or anything like that. You had to be in a regular military unit. And so, yeah, blacks got pensions. And in the North, of course, they had a lot more that served up there, but then there were a lot more whites that served in the Yankee Army than whites in the South. And the blacks and the U.S. Army had strictly segregated units. The blacks were all in one unit, whites in another. And another thing they did, the white officers didn't want to command a black unit. And so what they did, they took the bust outs from white units that were just totally incompetent. And the white soldiers wouldn't serve under these guys that were so bad. So they passed them off to be in charge of the black units. And that movie Glory they had about the 54th Massachusetts, and Matthew Broderick played that Lieutenant Gould, or Colonel Gould. Well, he was about to be kicked out of the Army. He was so incompetent. And his father was a big wheeler-dealer politician in Massachusetts, so they had to do something with him, so they passed them off on this black regiment. And that happened all the time. At Battle of Nashville, General Steedman was commanding black troops at the Battle of Nashville. He got them wiped out on the first day's Battle of Nashville on the 15th over at Raines Hill. And then on the next day, on the 16th, they tried an attack against the Confederates on Peach Orchard Hill, right close to where I used to coach high school football. And we found bullets and shell fragments all over the football field when they were building the football field. And they got wasted right there because Stedman, instead of attacking head-on, attacked across the front. So it's like targets coming across in front of you at the shooting gallery at the midway at the fair, you know, and they just mowed them down. They said from that hill up there close to where our football field was at Franklin Road Academy, or still is today, Confederate lines were up there at the crest of the hill. You could go from that crest of the hill all the way down to where the Interstate 65 is today at the bottom. You could go from the top of the hill to the bottom of the hill and never step on the ground. There were that many bodies laid out there in front of them. So the black soldiers were brave, but they had horrible officers. So anyway, we're going back to Patrick Claiborne, Army of Tennessee, at Spring Hill on the night or afternoon and night of November 29th. And his division was ready to move on the road and shut the road, close it off, so that, to keep Schofield's 23rd Army Corps from coming up the road and catching up with the rest of the Yankees that were skedaddling back to Nashville as fast as they could go. And this is one of the big controversies of the war, that Hood wasn't on the field, and he was sending orders to do things that had no idea what was going on 2 or 3 miles out in front of him. And that's where it was a big difference between someone like Hood and Forrest. Forrest was right smack in the middle of the battle, wherever it was, and he had total control of what was going on the field. And he could either praise his men or cuss them and, you know, threaten to shoot them if they didn't do what he told them to do. But he was right there on the field. It's like a head coach sitting up in the press box, and he doesn't have an idea of how the players are taking the game down on the sideline. So you want your head coach down on the sideline to get the mood of the players, and you want your commanding general close enough not to get shot out on the front lines, but to see what's going on. So Hood abandoned his job as a commander. Schofield's army tiptoed right by him that night and got away to Franklin. And then the next day, Hood sends his army into this suicide attack from Winstead Hill across 2 miles of open ground in trenches. The Federals weren't just standing there. There were old trenches built south of the town of Franklin back a year or two before, and they never were used. But when Schofield and his troops got there, they dug out these trenches and tore down buildings in Franklin for reinforcements and threw up these earthworks south of Franklin. And about 1 o'clock that afternoon, Claiborne, Frank Cheatham, and Bedford Forrest met at the Harrison House, which is still standing today. It's a two-story brick house if you ever go to Franklin. It's about 2.5 miles south of Franklin. They met there at 1 o'clock, And all his officers advised him against an attack because they'd scouted it out, and they said, this is suicide. You know, we'll lose half the army if we go across open ground and try this attack. And Forrest was the only officer that had been there the year before, and he knew all the roads around there, and he knew how to get around behind the Federal Army. He said, you give me one division of infantry and their artillery, we'll swing around to Hollow Tree Gap. And we'll put the infantry in the gap with their artillery. We'll put the cavalry on the flanks. And Forrest's words were, and this time we'll put the cork in the bottle. We'll have him. And Hood wouldn't listen to him. And David Wright did a painting of Forrest and Claiborne walking out from the Harrison house and talking to each other before they got on their horses and went back to their commands. Really a cool painting of those two officers standing there. And Forrest had a tremendous amount of respect for Claiborne, and I think Claiborne did for Forrest as well. But anyway, we know the outcome of that battle. About 4 o'clock that afternoon, Hood launched that attack, and his whole army wasn't there yet. Stephen D. Lee's corps was still coming up the road from Columbia, and most of their reserve artillery was still coming up from Columbia. So they didn't have any big artillery prep like before Pickett's charge at Gettysburg. They just threw the infantry out there in open ground and just got mowed down. And one of General Claiborne's brigade commanders, Daniel Govan, had the Arkansas Brigade. Most of the regiments in his command were from Arkansas, and he'd gone forward and scouted out the Federal position and came back there to Winstead Hill, well, Breezy Hill. They were on the other side of the road from Winstead Hill, Claiborne's division was. And he said, General, I don't think many of the boys are going to make it home to Arkansas. And Claiborne told him, well, Govan, if we are to die, let us die like men with our face to the enemy. And less than an hour later, Patrick Claiborne was dead on the battlefield at Franklin. He was riding his horse, and the horse got hit and wounded, and he dismounted, and the staff officer gave him another horse. They were getting close to the Federal works then. And right in front of their artillery at the cotton gin, which is one of the landmarks on the Franklin battlefield, he put his left foot up in the stirrup of this horse, horse's saddle, and the horse got hit with an artillery shell, and the horse literally exploded right out from under him and splattered blood and horse hair and everything all over it. He said, well, we're losing too many horses. I'm going in on foot. And he took his kepi off and put it up on the point of his sword and led his men. And about 25, 30 yards from the Federal works, he got hit two or three times. He went down and died on the battlefield there at Franklin. And the next day, they were picking up the wounded and trying to take them to Carrington and made a field hospital out of that Carrington home, plantation home there. They had the bodies of four Confederate generals laid out on the back porch at Carrington, and one of them was Patrick Claiborne. And Carrie McGavick, the wife of there at Carrington, the McGavick home, she got Claiborne's sword and his kepi and some of his personal items and hid them in the house because 2 weeks later, after the Battle of Nashville, the Yankees came back through there. Of course, the Confederate Army was retreating, and she didn't want the Yankees to get something from Claiborne and hold it up as like, yeah, look at what we got. And so the sword, the kepi, and his gloves and some of his other things are in the Tennessee State Museum now because Carrie McGavick saved them to keep the Yankees from stealing them. So Claiborne had, on the march up to Franklin, he'd gone by a church, and they'd stopped to take a break. And he got off the road and went looking around this church, and he said, this reminds me of the church in our hometown in Cork, Ireland. And he said, you know, this is such a beautiful place, it'd almost be a pleasure to be buried here. And little did he know, within two or three days, he was going to be buried in that churchyard. And then eventually they reinterred his body and took it back to Helena, Arkansas, and put it up on the hill there at the cemetery overlooking the Mississippi River. So that's our March birthday, March 17th, 1828, General Patrick Ronayne Claiborne.
Well, I'll tell you what, I know our listeners, our family, enjoy it as much as you do. And although it's entertaining, it always is. We always got to remember, it's part of our blood here in the South. It certainly is. We have some of the greatest leaders. We were maybe outnumbered, but we were never at fault. And I know everybody knows that. Well, thank you so much, Bitter Ender, for coming in and doing another stellar job, buddy. And thank you, Miss Lizzie, Miss Teenage America, for running the board. And I'd like to thank Monica and Matt, Jake, Jason, and Paul, and all our listening audience. So, same time, same place next week, y'all. Good night.